the Mysterious Universe, Season 34, Episode 5. Coming up on the show, we've got the sentient wall walkers, the hand that rocks the portal, and getting zapped by spirit. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
What do you say, getting zapped by spirit? Are you referring to this image that you have in the background here of what appears to be a sheriff with his hat blown apart?
This is Cleveland Sullivan. We've spoken about him a bunch of times before. This guy was...
Oh, that was multiple times, wasn't he?
Struck by lightning. Seven times, mm-hmm. to the point where it was coming down through the sky and then coming across through his open car window and into his hat lighting his hair on fire.
Wasn't it almost that it was seeking him out sometimes in the sense that he would try to hide from it if he saw a cloud or like he was actually terrified?
Yeah, and you can see in the image there, that's the hat that he was wearing that got smoked by the lightning strike.
It's rather astonishing that he managed to survive being struck by lightning, what is it, seven times? Yeah, seven times here.
Yeah, he's in the record books for the amount of lightning strikes. And it's interesting with these people, they become like lightning rods. There's a bunch of them I'll be talking about in the Plus extension. But it's not only the times they've been struck by lightning, it's like their entire perimeter gets struck by lightning. Like if you look into this guy and others, it's like their house gets struck by lightning twice a year. You know, their water tanks get struck by lightning. Their car gets struck by lightning. So even though he's been hit seven times, there was like 100 shots at him.
Really? How strange.
And there's another woman with a similar scenario. She was struck four times, but everywhere around her was getting hit all the time.
What, suggesting that like the lightning is tagging them and everything that is associated with them?
Yeah, there's a question about the nature of these people and why this keeps happening to them. So I went into Louis Proud's book, Strange Electromagnetic Dimensions, The Science of the Unexplainable, which is from a couple of years ago.
But Great book.
He's got a really good chapter on these kind of esoteric lightning strikes. And it's funny, like you see this story of Sullivan, which I just flashed up, and it's always portrayed as this kind of happy story. He's overcome this adversity of being struck by lightning seven times.
His life was destroyed.
And well, that's the thing that's kind of left out of these stories is people joke about them, and it's funny to joke, you know, people's shoes get blown off, but then they're fine.
When you say people, you mean us.
You have this idea of if someone survives a lightning strike, then they're usually fine. They go on to live a normal life. But from Louis's research, it's clear that that's not the case at all.
Well, people and lose fingers in some circumstances.
People that get struck by lightning and survive commit suicide.
Really?
It messes with their nervous system, with their neurochemistry. It changes their personality. And you might argue that, people have said that it makes them more grouchy. They're short-tempered. They have memory issues. So they're harder to be around. So these people end up having their relationships and their marriages break down. So they end up isolated. Maybe that's a contributing factor. But case after case, there are these horrible stories where, people's lives are destroyed. And I had this assumption. It's like, you survived this horrible thing, but now you're fine. And I almost thought about it in the same sense of a near-death experience, where people have near-death experiences and their life is transformed often for the better. And they have a new spiritual outlook on life. Sometimes
a profound understanding of reality.
They're no longer scared of death. Mm. They reorder the things they value in life. They start living their life differently. And often people describe having supernormal abilities as well. I often thought that getting struck by lightning might be a similar thing, but it's not. It's an absolutely life-destroying experience. However, there are some exceptions. And there are some exceptions which are highly strange, really strange.
You mean in that sense that they acquire some type of supernormal abilities?
Like, remember I was telling you the stories on the last Plus show of people that had been blind for years?
Yeah, and then suddenly after having a head injury, they were able to see again.
And then, like, one guy tripped over his guide dog.
That's right.
Smacked his head on the ground and he could see out of his good eye again. There's a bunch of stories that are associated with lightning that are a little bit like that, where the lightning strike corrects some horrific thing that happened to them earlier in life.
To be fair, perhaps you'll have different stories, but I have read these sorts of stories, but a lot of them seemingly come from like Victorian era quacks about, the way to fix this rather uncomfortable pox is to have yourself electrified at the full moon.
Electroshock therapy.
Yeah.
No, they're all new accounts.
Okay.
In fact, there's one that a woman from, I think the early 2000s, she wrote a book about her experiences. She was zapped. That's why I got that headline, zapped by the spirit. She says she was zapped by the spirit. Because it really was what I had assumed. It was like a near-death experience that changed her life.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this, though, because it feels like, in a sense, that there's like a predatory element to these things, especially like this guy being struck 7 times, but not just him, all the things around him. It was just today that I was reading, actually, and I didn't end up including it because I just had so much other stories. I'm like, I can't go into this. But it was of a guy who claims that he was driving along a road. It's got this classic kind of cliche, it feels like a UFO. He's driving along though in broad daylight, and as he's driving, he looks into his rear vision mirror, and there's like a black cloud following him, and it's a cloud, like it's just a cloud. And he's like, "What the hell is this?" And so he gets so uncomfortable about it, like he just feels like it's off, that he stops his car. He slams on the brakes, and the cloud like then moves over the front of his car, and then kind of sort of pulses in front of the vehicle, seeming like it was almost like charging up to do something.
What?
So he drove through it.
What happened?
It just kind of went boom. Yeah. That was it. It was gone. But there was this sense of urgency and this sense of fear that it was like, this isn't a normal cloud. This isn't normal activity. And it got me thinking about this predatory idea of like, it comes across as appearing as a natural phenomenon, but there's something sinister about it.
Well, there's a crossover with ball lightning and intelligent orbs.
I'll cover some of that stuff
today. Yeah, there's a story I'll share with you in the Plus Extension. It's one of these cases where a woman's been struck multiple times, but she recalls that in her early childhood, she had strange interactions with ball lightning.
Right.
With a very intelligent control behind it. So I'll be going into that.
Awesome. Well, I came across some similar stories, actually, a collection of stories, but some of it did involve like these weird orbs and perhaps, you know, and then I branched out into ball lightning because sometimes ball lightning is considered to be, there's an intelligence behind it because of the way that it behaves. It behaves in this very strange fashion that it seemingly is able to almost navigate, you know, very tricky situations, if you will, down to a maze. Like these things are quite clever.
My favorite story is the one that kind of came down and then tried to squirt itself through a keyhole.
That's right. It was peeping through the keyhole.
Yeah, it came through the keyhole.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, because they want to get into people's homes. Like it's really weird kind of stuff. But where I got inspired by this actually is I was digging through Strange Paranormal Realities in the Everyday World. It's by Andy Thomas. It's surprisingly, well, I shouldn't say surprisingly because I have read his other works and he's a good writer, but it's a really great book, like really well put together. And that's not just because it's the only book I found today, which is an AI slop. I was like, oh
isn't it just horrendous?
This is rather refreshing. Yeah, really great work. And
that's what happens now. Like you find a book that's written by a human being and it's just immediate, oh.
He does talk about AI, but it doesn't appear to be written by AI. So I'm like, I could deal with that. Like, it's fine. But you're right. It was just like, oh, my God. But the reason it resonated with me was because it, in a way, and it's just this weird synchronicity, it kind of flowed on from what we were talking about on the last Plus episode. And on the last Plus episode, we were talking about, yeah, you were describing these strange, you know, events of people miraculously recovering their abilities through injuries and those sorts of things. But also I was talking about a man who, after also being struck by lightning, developed supernormal abilities. If you recall, he could see people's auras. And in seeing people's auras, he then was able to, he set up a foundation or a group that would assist veterans who were didn't have anyone to be there at their point of death. So he would sit in hospice care with them and other people. And he was able to see their auras, and he was able to describe how the color of their aura would change and flow and the weird experiences that took place. But for many people, when you hear stories like that, they're at the absolute limits of what is possible, what is real. I think in some ways things have changed over the years, but the reality is people are very cynical, and I don't blame them for that, but people are very cynical. But there's this other layer on top of cynicism, right? There's an apathy of cynicism. It's like, yeah, I don't believe that or whatever, but people don't get too caught up in it. But there is a certain like percentage, it's not a lot, but there is a percentage of people that are like, yes, that's stupid and you're a moron.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And they get like, it actually somehow feeds their ego. It, even though in the face of, you know, compelling evidence, whether it's anecdotal or not, but they're in the face of compelling evidence like, oh no, you're a moron.
It makes you feel superior when you point out that other people are idiots.
Yeah, oh, and look, and they and they follow this dogma, unfortunately, which is this modern materialism and science, which is like, it's not science. Like science is the quest for truth at its ultimate heart. Mm. And unfortunately, you know, today science is being corrupted by money. It's corrupted by money. It's corrupted by politics. It's corrupted by opinion. Like anyone that's like, oh, my beloved science, it's like, you're an idiot. You're following along a religion. And funnily enough, a lot of the people that are like, oh, I'm so deep into science, religion's stupid, don't realize that they're actually following a new form of religion.
Well, it is the modern day religion.
Absolutely.
That's really what people believe, even people that say they're religious. Often when it comes to push, comes to shove, they defer on the side of science because that is what they truly believe in.
Yep, you're absolutely right. And so you've got people like, or researchers like Andy Thomas, and there's a difference, right? I think this is where the difference sits, is you have people who have had experiences and people who haven't. And I think people that have had experiences, some of them I feel like may fall into this category of really going down the hard materialism in science because their experience is so overwhelming and so detrimental to their view of reality that they push it away. Like they push it or they run away from it as far as they can. And then yet you have the other side of the coin where someone has an initiatory experience and it opens them up to all of these different realities, all these different worldviews.
Is that Thomas's angle? Is he one of these guys that's, very, very materialist in his thinking and just happened to open up a little bit for this book?
No, total opposite of that. He may have started off earlier on in life that way, but he's not like that at all. And let me just give you a couple of quotes from him. We'll go through his stories. And the reason why I actually went into this book is because there's a collection of theories and ideas that if you've been listening to Mysterious Universe for a while, I was like, oh, well, I'm not going to bother doing that. But his stories are collections that he's taken from people that people have provided to him over the years that he hasn't published, that he hasn't spoken about with these things. These are people that have come up to him at lectures because obviously he does lectures and tours and does research. People have come to him and said, look, this is an experience I've had. And he said something which was quite heartwarming as well. Many people that come to him with these experiences, and this is our experience as well, is that they don't want to seek fame. They're not wanting to seek attention. They're going to him because they know that he's a researcher in this field. They just want to be heard. They just want to say, well, I had this experience and I don't know what to make of it, but, can you provide some insight? And because, he's obviously researched this and has other stories, he may be able to provide some insight. Not that that's what he's doing. He's not acting as a counselor, as you will. But I found it to be really quite refreshing. And it's a good point. There are so many people out there that have had experiences and they don't know where to go to.
So what has he got? He's got some ghosts. He's got some UFOs.
He's got everything in there, right? So I won't go over, many of the stuff, but there are a few things that really stood out that grabbed my attention that particularly followed on from that last Plus episode. You don't need to have listened to that episode to get any of this context, but I just thought it was good how it flowed on. So he says, look, skeptics are impossible to please. No matter what evidence is presented for all their boasts of using scientific methods, if they have made up their minds, they will not believe in something that you're presenting them. Nothing will budge them. And they get very upset when confronted with things that do not fit their worldview. Amen. Don't we know that? He says, here's a scenario that I've experienced several. Yeah, that's exactly what happens. He's a lecturer and author on the paranormal. And he said, I've presented my case in front of audiences, sharing images, evidence, anecdotes, and I'm careful not to tell anyone what to think, but merely point out that certain cases may at least be worthy of discussion. And most seem happy enough to listen. But nonetheless, one figure will sometimes stand out. There'll be a person that will be in the crowd that will have this... they'll have a way about them, he says. And I'm like, we've seen this. There's like a sense of unease. There's a shuffling. There's even a direct shaking of the head. And their soul is agitated. It's like they're agitated. I'm like, why do we even go to these things? Is it attention seeking? Like, if you don't believe in this stuff and it's all garbage, then why even go? But he says they will get up and they have to communicate to everyone around them why their view is right and why our view is wrong. And he says, this has happened many times over and over again. And he says, once the lights are raised in the room, the figure will stand up and then the demolition of my character will begin. Because that's true. They don't attack you for what you're presenting. They attack you for what they think they can get you for, just not what's going on. And he says, look, there's also, I've been accused of returning the world to a dangerous dark age, producing a thinking that risks holding back the human race with wicked, unscientific ways. And that's just simply not the case. He has met with many, apparently sane, because obviously you're not running psych tests on them, but apparently sane, reliable people with astonishing tales to tell that reveal a very different world to the materialistically limited one that we are usually told that we live in. Fearing ridicule, many of them have remained silent amongst friends and relatives, but frequently share their stories with people like him because they know that I will hear them out. So he says, this book is really about talking about those experiences and then putting them onto the public record so that people can know, well, I'm not the only one having these experiences. But he says it remains a paradox that the mainstream still hesitates to report the paranormal seriously. And that's so true. I mean, even here in Australia, but you see it in the US, any time that there's something that's a little bit unusual being reported in mainstream media, what do they play underneath it?
X-Files music.
Every single time. Like it's every single time because it's not taken seriously.
Speaking of which, did you see the new X-Files reboot?
No. X-Files is being rebooted.
Yeah, the new reboot. So modern reboot, what do you think it's going to contain?
Oh, it hasn't been Netflix, has it?
Yeah.
You know what?
Zendaya and some other black actor?
It may be okay. I mean, we shouldn't judge it until it comes out.
Come on. Well, I mean, come on.
Is that real or is that AI?
What did they do to Scully?
Well, maybe
they destroyed Scully.
You know what? I saw her in, was it?
That's real, by the way. It's not AI.
The Queen or something. It was like really great actress. I didn't know how great of an actress she was. Anyway, forget the X-Files. Let's move on to this. So it says, those who already believe in the strange, we've been taught too often that these are subjects that we have to avoid, things that we shouldn't even talk about. So he has had numerous experiences that really kicked off his deep dive into this because he was working with crop circles.
All right.
And so working with crop circles, he describes back in the early 90s how he went to this one particular location somewhere in the UK. And as he was witnessing this crop circle, it changed him. Like it left an impression, it imprinted something upon him that's beyond just simply like we do. I mean, I've never seen a crop circle in real life, but I would imagine that being up close to these things, it gives you a different feeling, a different impression. It does something to you. And very much that's what's happened with him. I mean, this guy apparently was a guitarist or he was a musician at one point. You know, like his career has very much changed. He was working an office job, he says, early on. But he says one particular morning when he was younger, he was struck down with a back issue or a back injury or something like that. And because he was stuck at home, he grew up in a Roman Catholic household, but wasn't really following, you know, that path. It wasn't entirely for him. He started really reading about, you know, these paranormal topics as well. And that's what kind of opened his mind to these things. So it's like, it wasn't just the crop circle. It was simply just having an intrigue for these sorts of things. But he says the crop circle phenomenon, as we know, hasn't been treated kindly by the mainstream. And in fact, some paranormal investigators have shot down some of the crazy stories that come out of, you know, crop circle research, because crop circles aren't just a couple of guys with a wooden plank in a field that are, you know, trudging stuff down. There's a lot of high strangeness attached to them. You know, you've got people describing weird lights that are moving through them. You've got Nick Redfern pulling up reports of people seeing gargoyle-like creatures that fly above them, or people being attacked by black cats.
And the weird European-looking humanoids.
That's right, yeah.
There's a bunch of those
as
well. Yeah,
weird humanoids attached to them. So he says, you know, pretty much from my own research, much of what is said in the mainstream is simply incorrect. And there are substantial reports of, like, case files of these reports that suggest that it's not just a single person having a hallucination or trying to get attention. They reinforce themselves over and over again. Now, just before I jump into a couple of the stories, he actually has what he calls the paranormal top 10, and he lists the collection of what type of reports he commonly gets. Strangely enough, I would have thought UFOs were the top, but they're the second. Number one is actually ghosts and poltergeists, but number 10 is sightings of unusual creatures.
Ranked in order of what? What's this list?
Like about how many cases does he get? Like what's the most common cases that he gets? But I found it to be quite strange that you would have experiences at ancient sites to be more popular than sighting cryptozoological creatures. Mm. But I thought after that episode we just did on the Loch Ness Monster, it's like, is it that are we just not going outside anymore? Is that why people aren't having these encounters? I was reading an article earlier this week where sightings of UFOs in the UK are plummeting. Like absolutely plummeting. And the suggestion was is that apparently the showing of the craft hasn't been reduced. It's just the reporting of it because people aren't looking up at the sky anymore. We're all inside.
Well, everyone's looking at their phones.
Yeah.
No one's looking around.
No one's looking around. So we're getting cut off from these things. So yeah, like he says, look, make no mistake. There is an open war against paranormal beliefs. And we've spoken about this group. There's like the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, the CSI. You know, they've got famous scientists and academics, and they are, you know, part of a group that is, you're trying to cleanse Wikipedia of positive coverage of this kind of stuff. So we know that it's out there. But much of the stuff that he starts off in one of the earlier chapters of his book is talking about these visits from beyond the grave. And it kind of does flow on from that last show about people seeing auras. But this is more about the fact that people have a lot of encounters with ghostly-like apparitions, and they don't know what to do with them. Now, I've highlighted some of the more unusual ones here. Of course, there's plenty of people just seeing, you know, a ghost, if you will, passing through their home. But there's a couple that come out here. So there's one that comes from the West Country of England. This was the mid-1990s. Apparently, they booked an accommodation at a cheap trailer park. It was near the village of, or in the village of Loon, if I pronounce that correctly, in Cornwall. But he says, after we arrived after a long drive, he says, Phil, who was one of his friends, another fellow that's, you know, deeply ingrained in this kind of these topics, he said that there was something that was a little bit off about the place, and their peace was disturbed by the sound of a young boy and girl beyond the partition door. He said it was very clear, like they could hear the sound of this boy and girl, and they were playing and having fun, and they could hear their footsteps, and they could actually feel them vibrating through the bottom of the trailer. And he said, I decided to shoo them away, like just calm, like not tell them off, but just calm them down. And he says he walks outside and pulls the door aside, and instantaneously all the noises that were being made stopped. He said there were no children there. There was no sounds. And I checked everywhere, the door where the children must have been, it was firmly bolted. There was just absolutely nothing. Now, he said, this is really, really odd, because that particular evening, he apparently had gone to bed and he was trying to get to sleep. So he's definitely awake. It wasn't like he was going into this hypnagogic state that, you know, sometimes people can have weird experiences. But in that same trailer, something grabbed hold of his leg and then just shook it. He says it wasn't nastily, but it was certainly firm. There was a firmness to it. Now, he thought, is this some type of mischievous joke? And he thought that this was Phil. So he gets up to, you know, go and tell Phil off. And Phil's like, he's asleep. Like, he's asleep in there. So it's like this physicality that comes from this. Now, of course, he relates this because he's a researcher and he talks to other people around that are in the trailer park. And the locals are like, oh, yeah, like, that's completely normal. Plenty of people have visitations from these invisible children that seemingly live in this trailer park. So it's like, there's nothing scary about it. It's like this matter-of-fact kind of thing that occurs, but there's a physicality that comes from it as well, which kind of goes, we've been talking about the stone tape theory recently, about it's a repeating occurrence of some type of event, but there's no trauma here. But these ghosts seemingly are sentient, like they're capable. And this is one of the headlines that I put in the show. I called it the sentient wall walkers, because in a moment I'll get into them. But there's so many of these reports of where it's people living in homes that have been renovated, and these ghostly figures, but they look solid for the most part, will walk through walls. Mm-hmm. But they don't just simply do it. Like, it suggests that there is this recording effect, because it will happen over and over. But in many of these cases, which is rare, but they actually acknowledge the person who's witnessing them. There's an acknowledgement that doesn't normally happen in these stone tape reports or these, you know, recurring stories that come up. There was another case that comes from Mary Helen Hensley. Now, she had this experience that was triggered by a near-death experience. She had a severe car accident, actually. And after having this car accident, she seemingly had her perception of reality changed, which is one of these, again, these initiatory events. She apparently, much like these children hanging around, she was on the Queen Mary, known for being, you know, a haunted location. She claims that these two children, or this one particular girl, I'm sorry, was like giggling behind her. So she turns around to see this little girl following her down the hall. And she said she wore this drop waist white dress. It had pleats at the bottom. Like, it was very detailed, the information that she was taking in, but it was of a very solid form of this little girl. And somehow, though, Mary knew that she was laughing because she could see her. Mm. She realized that, hang on a second, she's not supposed to be there. Now, as is written by Andy, he says meeting a child in a corridor is not that particularly unusual, except for the fact that the child vanished mysteriously as she had appeared. She kind of just disappeared directly in front of the girl. And later on, Mary found out that apparently she matched the description perfectly of a child, a poor girl who had drowned in the ship's swimming pool 50 years earlier. So it's like, this goes further on to what we were talking about recently with the idea that perhaps entities can get trapped in a certain location. Like, they can be, for whatever reason, they're caught in the field. And again, this comes back to T.C. Lethbridge, where he was talking about water seemingly impacting this. So this is a ship. But with that kind of stuff as well, it normally has this recurrent kind of non-interactive feel about it. But this one was that the girl was interacting, but seemingly interacting with a psychically sensitive person. He also writes that I was invited to speak in Edinburgh, actually, at the home of what is now the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle Centre. And he said everyone had left and they were staying in the accommodations there. And he knew that they were the only people in the building. And he said, we ascended these darkly atmospheric stairs and we put ourselves away in the flat. But as we lay there, we were attempting to slumber. We were thwarted by the constant shouting through the wall from an adjacent dwelling. He said, we couldn't hear words, but we could hear a man's voice. It was angry and aggressive. Now, if it wasn't just the fact that it was someone yelling, it was then punctuated by bangs and crashes as if furniture was being moved and thrown about. He said we were hoping that this would subside, but the sound persisted into the early hours of the morning. He said finally they were just so weary that they passed out. But the next morning they related the incident to their hosts, and their hosts were actually quite shocked because they said, there's actually nobody living on either sides of this building. It's like a terrace house and there was no one there at all. So what is it about Andy that was causing, like, is it about him that was allowing them to sense this or hear this? But then, of course, there's someone else with him, so it's got a second person experiencing it. But what a strange report as well, because there's no direct interaction with any type of ghostly form, but the anger and it's almost a poltergeist kind of thing. But I wonder, again, it's like a person, you know, like Andy, who's a researcher, because he's already been delving into so much of this stuff, he really is just lit up on that astral plane. It's like this stuff, you become a magnet for it. And, you know, this, you know, continues over and over. Then he gets into more cases that kind of fit in with some of the earlier research from the society, what's it called? The Society for Psychical Research.
Yeah, SPR.
He was talking about things like crisis apparitions and those sorts of things, which are pretty common. But there are a couple that kind of, you know, stand on the outer limits for him. He says there's one. He says, shortly before my godmother Brenda died of cancer, she was in her 50s. She had voiced her disappointment that due to her ill health, she'd been unable to visit her friend. Now, a friend was just this elderly lady who lived very nearby, and Brenda would go and spend time with her. And unfortunately, this had fallen away because of what was going on with Brenda. But the day Brenda died, this lady, sound of mind, like even though she was elderly, she certainly had all of the marbles. She was talking to a visiting carer, and this carer apparently was told by this lady, oh, it was so nice that Brenda finally got a chance to come and see me. She looks like she's doing so well. Now the carer, because apparently just how this works, maybe it's a small town, the carer knew that Brenda had died a couple of hours earlier. And yet this woman had no idea. And of course the carer says, I'm sorry, that possibly can't have happened because Brenda died. And she was insistent. She's like, no, she absolutely did come to visit me. And it turns out that, and somehow she knew the time. She must have kept a record of the time. That was precisely the moment she had died. So one of these weird kind of crisis apparitions where, you know, it was reported by Podmore back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, of people having these connections with long lost loved ones or friends at the moment of the point of their death. And of course, Andy says it could be a hallucination, but what's the coincidence that such a hallucination would occur on that day at that very moment? Like, it's a bit weird that that would happen. There's also this one called Awkward Relatives. So this is about Thelma and Michael. They lived in this old house with a narrow staircase. And one day Michael was alarmed to find a strange man sitting halfway down the stairs. He was wearing a straw hat and smoking a pipe. When Michael gently asked him who he was, the figure stood up and simply faded away. Now, Michael was terrified. He rushed to tell Thelma. And the description that he gave, she's like, And I'm thinking when I read this, I'm like, oh, just like, has she seen the ghost and she didn't want to talk about it? She's like, oh, no, that's my ex-husband who's passed away. I had to tell you that I've kind of kept a candle alight for him and I've even been setting the dinner table for him. So it's
wow, like, she's kept him going.
She's kept him going. It's kind of like almost like the Hungry Ghost, but in reverse. Like she's kept him anchored in some way by, but apparently knowing that the game was up, Thelma got out her old photo albums and showed Michael his predecessor, who confirmed that that was indeed the man that he had seen. Now, apparently their marriage survived and no further visitations were recorded. So I thought that's a bit weird. Like I would get it. The only thing I was thinking was, is it a Tulpic form? Like, it's because, like, she was still in love with her deceased husband.
Yeah, that's an idea. Maybe she released that thinking when she found someone new.
Yeah, but then, I mean, then he interacted with it. But I guess you could interact with the topic form. But it was just strange that once she'd kind of come out with it, that it all just kind of, it stopped. You've also got faces. Now, this is something that's really, really unusual that comes up. But faces and hands are this recurring theme that happens in paranormal phenomena, which goes beyond, again, it's not just a simple ghost sighting. It's a connection. It's a physicality that comes with these reports. One comes here from a woman named Caroline. Apparently, after her mother died, very shortly after she had died, Carolyn was fully awake when she gently saw a glowing face of her mother in the corner of the room. It was up high near the ceiling, much like what you hear of people that are having near-death experiences or that are at the threshold, you know, in their deathbed or in their hospice bed, they'll look up into the corner of the room. But she said she wasn't frightened. It was just this smiling, comforting face. And she felt that this was some type of sign from her mother that she was now happy and safe. Now, apparently when Caroline spoke to Andy, she seemed very grounded and matter-of-fact about it. But what when it happens to us, apparently it's like the strange doesn't feel so strange. And Caroline hadn't thought about her experience for years until she heard Andy talk about it by another person. So it's like hearing reports of other people. So it's this weird effect as well that the face was glowing. And ghosts are commonly in popular culture, like in cartoons.
What is this, a Scooby-Doo cartoon?
Well, yeah, they're portrayed as glowing, right? But that ties back into like this auric stuff we were talking about, people being able to see these energy fields around a spirit or as someone passes away. You've also got Adelaide. So Adelaide had this Chesterfield chaise sofa in her bedroom. And one night, with the lights on, right? So the lights are on. She looks up and she says in the region of the arm of where the side of the sofa was, she said there was the face of a young girl staring out from it. Now, at first, she thought this was her daughter, but then she realized that she's like, hang on a second, this face is completely unfamiliar. And the face was coming through the sofa. So it was like someone was kneeling down and pushing their face through the sofa, but there was no body behind. She was so startled that for whatever reason, she ran towards the sofa and apparently the girl's face melted away. It's weird.
It's the first thing I'll do if I was a ghost.
Just stick your face through a sofa?
I'd be sticking my head through all your furniture at home. But
that's as well.
Like you specifically, Aaron.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that, Ben.
I'd be coming out of your fridge like you go and get a drink and I'll just be like... What are you doing?
Yeah, but that's the
is
thing.
That, is that good for you?
Going back to this point before, though, the strange no longer is strange. Like, oh, yeah, hey, Ben. Yep, all right, slam. That would be it. You've got the astrologer, Jonathan Kaner. Now, he sadly has passed on now, but he had an experience of seeing the face of his first wife, Melanie, was spoken. Melanie, what the hell's going on with me today? Had a spoken conversation. This was at the very moment that she was dying in operating theatre.
What, he just saw her face?
No. So apparently, what happened? It was 1992. She had been involved in a serious car accident with a lorry, with a truck. They had 7 young children, including 2 7-month-old twins to care for. And Jonathan was unable to be at the hospital while she underwent, serious surgery. Now, as he was serving dinner to his children, he was obviously anxiously waiting the news. This bizarre apparition opened up in the corner of the kitchen a few feet above the floor. He said he described it as being like a television screen materializing in the air, but he saw his wife's face hovering in a shimmering blue light. It was serene, and it told him that she was going. Apparently, Jonathan protested this and said he still needed her, but her image and voice dissipated.
That's interesting because the description of it appearing as a television screen in his head, that's typically...
Well, it sounds like a psychic effect,
doesn't it? That's typically how people describe the third eye functioning.
Right.
Even, you know, those reports from kids in China, all those experiments they did in the 70s and 80s, they would always describe a television screen appearing, like a little screen in their mind's eye. Mm. We've heard countless people describe that.
Well, this
so maybe she turned it on for him momentarily.
Yeah, well, it's not described if it was seen by the children, but he later discovered that his wife had died at almost this exact moment. Mm. So again, it ties in with these kind of...
you got to add that detail. That's the standard detail.
Well, it is. Yeah, it's really important. There's also this one here. Shortly after her husband Peter had died, Barbara frequently had this disconcerting feeling of him still being physically next to her in the bed.
Gross.
Even when she wasn't asleep, she could feel the mattress bending towards the presence.
Till death do us part, dude. Just let it go.
Later, though, Barbara went on a cruise as part of her bereavement process, and one day a bright ball of light appeared in her cabin for just a few seconds. As it hovered just a few inches across, she felt instinctively that it was Peter again, now in a more ethereal form. Yet seemingly he still had an influence over the physical world, because at home Barbara would leave her slippers around in an untidy manner and they would always be put back in place. Another one, a friend traumatized by the recent loss of her father looked at her window at the nearby hills one night to see a bright orb hovering just above the garden, while UFO hunters or earth mystery aficionados would immediately become excited for other reasons. For her, the timing of the light's arrival was exact and a reassuring sign that it was her father's presence. And that does come up a bit, this weird effect of glowing balls of light, glittering kind of stuff. These sorts of reports show up quite a lot for people after they have the passing of a loved one. And yeah, like in some cases, they seem to be like UFOs. And I even witnessed by other people, like across the road or, you know, about town, like, oh, I saw a UFO. It's like, well, no, it happened just after, you know, the passing of my father or something like that. But the fact that there's this third party that witnesses them gives it some validity as well. Let's go on here to another experience, though. He says Tom had been skeptical about the supernatural, but events in his own home changed this. When his son was young, the boy claimed that an elderly gentleman with a hat and old-fashioned white clay pipe would come into his bedroom at night. Apparently, he was carrying some type of scythe-like farming instrument over his shoulder.
What?
Yeah, I know, right?
Oh, my God.
So the man would sit at the end of the bed and talk to him.
Now, that's what I'm going to do to you. I'm going to come through your furniture and I'm going to get random farming equipment. Mostly scythes.
See, but you should do that, because then I know that it is you. Because then, like, I would... The only person who would do that would be a deceased Benjamin Grundy. Apparently, the Grim Reaper connotation is nothing to be concerned about, because the child found the gentleman kindly and unafraid, or was unafraid of him. The reason why this really stands out, though, is because the kid starts telling his father, like describing him. Now, Tom was rather, you know, shocked by the fact that it was a perfect depiction of the boy's great-grandfather. So Tom's grandfather, he was long dead before the son was born, but guess what he was? He was a farmer and he would often carry agricultural implements. So it's like,
does he pick any other instrument, dude. You're going to visit your grandson as a dead dude. Don't bring a scythe with you.
Maybe he was like
anything else. An auger even would be better.
Maybe he thought a pitchfork was too much. Like a pitchfork, it's a bit much.
Even that's better than a scythe.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, you're probably right.
What's he thinking?
You've got a report from Muriel when her grandfather died in his old rocking chair. Actually, I should say that. I don't know if he died in the rocking chair, but somehow his spirit was trapped in the rocking chair, because they bring the rocking chair home, right? And apparently each morning their young daughter would describe seeing an old man in the chair at night just gently rocking. Now, they were freaked out by this, so they took the chair out of a room and no one else witnessed anything. But one day when they were looking through an old family photo album, apparently Muriel's daughter was like, oh, that's the man that's in my bedroom. The photo turns out to be the deceased grandfather. So it's like...
We've had a bunch of stories like that of, you know,
like
men that are attached to their classic cars.
Yeah, that's right.
And when they pass away, the car starts acting real strange, like it's inhabited by something. So it's funny what people get attached to, you know, during their physical life. And that attachment, like we always say, it doesn't just magically vanish when you die. It's like if you're a drug addict during your life and then you die,
you're still a drug addict
when you're dead.
Yep,
it doesn't magically go away.
Yep. And that's why, and then that ties in with, you know, attachment, spirit attachment, possession, that kind of stuff. Well, imagine getting obsessed with your washing machine, essentially, and then being trapped with it.
Wow.
Into the afterlife. It's not even
a
washing machine.
It's a bit misogynistic, Aaron.
Oh, it is a bit misogynistic. So there was Roland. He was a boy. His mother actually asked him to carry this hefty old-fashioned iron. It was like a metal washing mangle. So it's not even a washing machine. It was like those old things with rollers in it that you would like turn the handle and you put
things.
The clothes through and it would squeeze all the water out. Now, he's like, this is way too heavy. There's no way that I can bring this up the stairs. And so Roland was a bit worried. And then serendipitously, at that very moment, this man appears and he says, don't worry, son, I'll give you a hand. And Roland apparently is very grateful for this helper. And the two of them carry this heavy thing up the stairs, far too heavy for this Roland kid to carry it up himself. Now, when he gets up, the mother's like, oh, that's really good. And he's like, well, my friend helped me. And she's like, what friend? What are you talking about? And he's like, oh, yeah, this guy. And she's like, but the doors are locked and there's just no way that anyone can get the house. He's like, no, it was this guy. And he gives this description and she's just white. She just goes pale because it's the perfect description of the uncle who had died 10 years earlier. So again, this like weird familial or ancestral kind of connection that comes through.
It's not weird at all. It's just normal.
Well, yeah, it is. But then, so there's this other one. So if you recall a while ago, Ben, you covered a story actually of monks in Japan that had certain shrines or places where women who had gone through abortions could go and have their baby kind of calmed. Or
yeah,
have
you pay a monthly fee.
Yeah.
To keep the spirit.
Keep the angry spirit.
Appeased.
Right.
Of your dead fetus.
Well, that doesn't just happen in those circumstances. Apparently it happens during stillbirths as well. Like a horrible thing. But Priscilla told Andy this story about her daughter's first baby. So sadly this baby was stillborn, but 2 years later, a rainbow baby came about. It was she gave birth to a healthy girl.
What is a rainbow baby?
A rainbow baby is a child you have after you've had a stillbirth.
Oh.
So I like that idea because it's like it's a very joyous thing to celebrate. So after such a terrible thing takes place. But not necessarily so for the other child, because the healthy girl named Ava, when she was around 3 years of age, Ava started describing nightly visits from a girl who would float above her bed. But far from being this pleasant guardian angel, apparently the girl was spiteful, saying things like, "Your mummy is not your mummy, she's my mummy."
Oh boy.
Concerned, the family made the reasonable presumption that this must have been the spirit of the dead baby displeased at having been usurped by Ava. And apparently from Ava's description, this child was growing at the same age as what she would have when she was born. Now, yeah. There's no way that Ava could have known any of this. Like, she was 3 years old. She had no knowledge of this. But apparently things started to feel more dangerous because it was causing trouble for Ava. I don't know exactly what was happening, but there was a box of trinkets connected with the stillborn baby that the mother couldn't usually bear to part with. It itself started radiating a bad feeling. The family's cats and dogs wouldn't go near it, and the visitations were starting to affect Ava's childhood. Despite moving house several times, the ghost followed them. Finally, the parents decided to hold a ceremony celebrating the stillborn's life, but imploring the spirit to leave the sister alone and move on. It apparently has done so now.
You need a psychopomp.
Yeah, it kind of is.
You need
like
something
that, isn't
like
it?
That. Yeah. It's like people think the whole Japanese thing where they're paying money to appease the spirit of the dead baby is just some kind of tradition.
Mm.
It has a function.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's like, and maybe because, I mean, a stillbirth is such a terrible thing. I think for some people, perhaps you get caught up in the grief of it, and perhaps you don't maybe follow the right. I shouldn't say it's right, but maybe it's like what I'm saying is they're not like so caught up in the grief that it's like this. It's not given a proper send off.
Yeah, maybe or something like that.
You know what I mean? And then by not doing that, by not calming the situation, it's like it's stuck hanging around, and that's why you get these sorts of situations. It's just my theory. Then of course, like Andy points out, the technology has changed things as well because. You know, now we've got baby monitors in people's bedrooms, in babies' bedrooms, obviously, maybe in people's bedrooms. But obviously, you've got infrared as well. You've got motion detection on these sorts of things. So with the introduction of such tools, you do have an uptick in these sorts of reports of people saying that, you know, like the video, the monitor will go off or the motion detection will go off and they'll go and check it and there's nothing going on. The child hasn't moved. But then you would find anomalous orbs and objects being, you know, moving about the room. Reports of deceased relatives appearing in photographs of family gatherings start turning up more often. Like all these sorts of things start to, basically get picked up more often by the technology. But unfortunately, and this is something that he addressed a little bit later on, in a world of Photoshop, it's like people are still really cynical about it. Like you can have these images and videos that are captured, but because there are a bunch of people out there that do hoax stuff, it undermines the legitimacy of a lot of this stuff. And it's like, even if you have the photographic evidence, people will just run with it and say, oh no, that's Photoshopped, or oh no, that's AI now. Mm. So we're not any closer to trying to provide a smoking gun that can prove that this stuff is happening. But where I think the truth in this lies is that there's just so many people that have these experiences that no matter how skeptical you are, you perhaps just have to for a moment go, maybe there is something more to this. There's something else going on here. He says also there's a story of unending battles. So James, he said, told me some years ago that he was walking down the aptly named Dead Man Tree Hill. This is a rural road between English villages of Barkham and Cooksbridge in East Sussex. It was night, but he said apparently as he was walking, he unexpectedly heard this thundering horse's hooves kind of galloping towards him. There were men's voices. There were shouting, aggressive tones. He was very disturbed and, you know, very concerned that he was about to be ridden down. Some mob was coming after him. So he looked about and saw nothing, but he was frozen to the spot as the clamor kind of continued, going around him. Now, for whatever reason, a car came around the corner and this seemingly broke the spell, and instantaneously the sounds were gone. But he looked into it and he found out that this particular road in 1264, there was a bloody battle that took place not 2 miles up this road. Apparently, the men that were fleeing fled along this path. There was about 2,000 men on both sides that died in this battle. So it was like the battle had spread into the surrounding areas with this psychic impression that was left behind on this particular road. And that road that he was walking on, apparently blood ran down the hill there. And he says, look, I've, you know, after hearing the story, investigated the area many times and discovered that there's been actually multiple reports of people describing the same thing, this spiritual medieval carnage flowing into the modern world, an echo of it at the very least. I thought, yeah, that's true. I mean, you do hear these sorts of things. And he mentioned this as well. I won't go into it in great detail, but like the Battle of Gettysburg, you know, multiple people have claimed that in some circumstances they can see it, but can't hear it, or in the other circumstances, they can hear it, but they can't see it. And sometimes they get completely caught up in the whole thing. But there are multitudes of reports of people reporting similar things of these battles repeating over and over. He says this same thing happens at air and train crash sites. You know, people that are lost in the incident, they seemingly generate loops of sound. So it's like not so much that people will see like a plane crashing, but they'll hear a noise flying overhead. They'll hear a crash, they'll hear cries, that kind of stuff. And that will be... It's not just the UK. There's reports of this all around the world. Then there's a story of Marjorie. So Marjorie used to live in a house that wasn't very old, but it did incorporate wooden beams that had been salvaged from an earlier house that was lost in a fire. Marjorie's daughter and daughter's boyfriend would often sense a presence and hear a distinctive sound, almost like the rustling of a long dress. One night, Marjorie's son, around 16 at the time, started screaming from his bedroom when they rushed in to investigate. He said he had seen a tall lady in a Victorian dress standing at the foot of his bed, though he'd been unable to see her face. Although Marjorie and her husband never personally experienced anything, they did believe their family's claims that the son was deeply unnerved by what he had witnessed. They all felt that the wooden beams from the burnt house had actually conveyed this spirit into their home. And it just so happens that, yeah, the beams had come from a Victorian home that had burnt down. Whether or not the lady had died in it, we don't know. But this is a good example of this almost like psychometric effect that happens where materials can, you know, it doesn't have to be the whole house to cause a haunting to take place. It can be a singular material that's brought into a home. There was another one as well, actually. I'll just skip forward to it. Where is it one here? So Pauline told me in the months after her father's death that the living room, which he would regularly sit, apparently he would smoke a pipe. Now, apparently the house would just mysteriously fill up with cigarette smoke every day. Now, she thought that perhaps the father's favorite chair and the carpets and the curtains were imbued with all the years of his smoking, and that's why somehow the smoke was coming back. That was, of course, until they realized that it was like the father, much like what you were talking about with a drug addict, even though you're not a drug addict if you're, you know, smoking, but you are, you know, there is a connection to the nicotine. It's like he was unable to kick the habit in the afterlife. And that's why he would smoke. The smoke would be coming through into the home. And it may sound humorous, Andy writes, but mediums have related many times that there's a continued yearning for earthly addictions and can actually become a problem for some spirits, causing them to be unable to move on from this realm. And that's so true. I mean, there's so many times that we've heard that. But then the book kind of moves into things like astral travel, spiritual tourists, and those sorts of things where, and we did this only recently, where if you're astrally traveling and you encounter people, now he doesn't say this directly, that you're in danger of becoming, you know, possessed or suffering a spirit attachment. But if you're an astral traveler or a spiritual tourist, as he calls them, and you encounter one of these dark souls that's completely wrapped up by worldly obsessions, you're in a lot of danger because they need some type of interface to access the physical reality.
They'll do whatever they can to get into you.
That's you. Yep. They'll get into you. So then, of course, this continues as well. This is only a little story, but it's about Margaret. Margaret apparently lived in a row of stoned, like it was terraced stoned cottages. Each had its own chimney, but the chimneys had been closed off and the places, all of them had been renovated. Of course, they left the chimneys for the aesthetic of the building, but the fireplaces had been closed in, replaced with modern radiators. But Margaret was alarmed one day when she was coming home from work and alarmed to see that there was smoke pouring out of her chimney. She dashed inside thinking that a fire had broken out somewhere. She was checking the rafters, but there was no smoke or flames inside whatsoever. So she calls a workman to come and investigate. And he's doubtful. He's like, there's no way that you saw smoke pouring out of your chimney. There's just no way that that happened. And she's like, well, can you just check the house and make sure that there's, you know, perhaps it's in the walls or in the ceiling. Is there a small fire or something? So he checks. He says, no, there's absolutely nothing. And the fireplace itself, it's not just the fireplace. The entirety of the chimney is firmly blocked. There's no way for anything to come out. There's no residue of fire in the attic, nothing. Now, Margaret was embarrassed. But she's like, well, perhaps I didn't really see what I saw. Who knows? She asked the neighbors if they saw anything. They said no. But then in some weird synchronicity, that very workman was driving past the house on another day when he saw the smoke for himself puffing out the chimney. He pulled over, ran to the cottage, anxious to investigate, but once again, there was nothing visible inside and no possibility that smoke could have come from the fireplace, chimney, or anywhere else. Strange.
Well, it's got to be up there.
Oh, come on. Just
the ghost smoke story.
What my point is with this is that, and what Andy highlights.
Top 10 spooky stories.
I'm glad he included this, though, because this is a great example of where people think hauntings and this supernatural phenomenon has to be all about the living. It has to all be about some type of agent of an entity that's going through your house. And that's not the case at all. Because like smoke, even smoke itself can have this ghostly kind of effect.
This is going back to the pure stone tape theory.
Mm.
Right. But why would that occur? What's the significance of smoke coming out of the chimney?
Exactly. And then, but also this weird connection, though, of like, why is it? I mean, was it just simply a coincidence that he happened to be driving past at that time and then he sees it? Like, why is that taking place? He says, look, the other thing that comes through quite a lot, it's widely reported in the number of reports that he gets from people, is that it's the phenomenon of ghosts walking in and out through walls, like solid walls. And there's a great example. So this is Roger and Joan. They owned this grand old house. It had this large ornate fireplace. And this fireplace was a favorite spot for them because they had armchairs placed on either side. And apparently it was a beautiful retreat in winter. But one afternoon, this coziness was not so cozy because they were sitting there with hot drinks and newspapers when they became aware of a glow. This glow seemed to be different from the flames that were coming off the logs. And the shape of the light began to grow before their eyes. It expanded from the fireplace until, to their utter astonishment, it became a full-sized figure of a woman in period dress. Now, unusually, this spectral figure stepped out of the fireplace and acknowledged Roger and Joan. Apparently, she turned her head to look at them specifically and nodded to each one of them, completely unperturbed by the fact that she'd just stepped out of a fireplace and there were strangers in this location that she was.
Was it a really old fireplace? It had always been there?
No, they put it there.
Okay, so renovation.
Renovation, right? So this figure observes, looks around in this old garb or like this dated garb, then walks across the room and vanishes through the opposite wall. Now, the woman was not seen again, but Roger and Joan said that when they'd renovated this house, there had indeed been a door, at that particular location, which had been covered up by them, and obviously the fireplace had been installed. But then for it to kind of like grow, like it grew like a light out of the fireplace, it's in broad daylight, it's just a really strange kind of report. You've also got Susan and David. They apparently would frequently see a male figure walking into their lounge as if through nowhere from a wall. It would always advance towards them as if preparing to say something and then just simply disappear. It's like it doesn't have enough energy to get out what it needs to say. And they said that they were having worked on the house later on, they discovered that there had once actually been a doorway in the exact spot where this man would materialize. You've got Mildred. This is a joint experience because she had the experience with her husband. They were exploring maritime buildings at the foot of an old railway in this English coastal town. They apparently said that when they were wandering about, they noticed that there were a group of people that were wearing Victorian-style clothing, assuming them to be some kind of tourist attraction. They were all stunned when the group just suddenly turned and walked through a heavy closed door that fronted an undercellar, melting as if it wasn't even there. So this wasn't even a time slip, but these ghostly figures walked through a solid door, but they appeared themselves to be solid.
I'm also going to do this to you. I'm going to have a scythe.
Can you stop?
I'm going to stick my face through your fridge and I'm just going to be randomly walking through your walls.
I don't need that, okay?
I'm going to make smoke come out of your chimney.
Well, you need to find a house as well that I've renovated and closed up a door so you come through the door where I was like, oh, look, there was a door there.
Ghost okay. smoke. I'll do really spooky stuff like turn your taps on.
That's not spooky.
Ooh.
That's not going to work either.
Or I'm going to make the lights flicker on and off.
That's not.
You'll wet your pants a little bit when that happens. You'll be like, Grundy.
I've seen
get
a ghost.
Out of my house.
Actually, there's like, this is the thing. So this came up in a story as well. So I've seen a ghost, as many people know. And in that, the head, it wasn't like a creepy kind of thing of where the head had been like decapitated. And it was all, the head just wasn't there. It was like it was just cut off from reality. Well, there's a story in here of where there's one eyewitness who apparently, if I recall correctly, because I didn't save that one either, but it just came to my mind, where they the child would constantly say that there was like a ghostly figure that would come to the side of the bed, right? And they were kind of shocked about this. This is the mother. And the mother, one evening after the child had complained, if I recall correctly, about there being the ghost in the room, they went into the room and they couldn't see the form, even though the child could. She looked down and she could see the feet, like, and the legs.
Yeah, right.
It was like that was there, but the other part of it was, but yet the child could see it.
There's all those stories from the mountain in Spain where people would be driving up these mountain roads and just see a pair of jeans walk across the road. There's a pair of legs.
Yeah, isn't it? It's really strange because that's highlighted, and because another case that comes up is Roman soldiers. Like, that seems to be quite a common thing as well. And there's that classic case of the guy that was working in his cellar, if you recall, and this is in the UK, in England, and he saw like a legion of Roman soldiers like march through his cellar. But because the cellar had been renovated, the floor was a little bit higher, but they were clearly walking on an old road. It was like an old, and they walked at the same height that they would have been. So they walked through the renovation.
Yeah.
But then it's strange, you're right, that there's the opposite side of where people saw just like a pair of jeans, like just legs running.
Well, the classic Nick Redfern report of the woman that claims she saw a saber-toothed tiger, but its legs were in the ground.
That's right. Yeah. Like these.
Like it was walking on the ground from 10,000 years ago.
Yeah. So is that what it simply is? It's like we go back to this stone tape thing, but then why is it still like, why doesn't it change height with the landscape? And then why doesn't the landscape disrupt the, you know, that presenting?
When itself? I haunt you, you'll just see my socks. My socks and my underpants.
I don't need.
Just walking through your house.
Right. Just fantastic.
With a scythe.
Yeah. Just, yeah, I see a floating scythe, a pair of underpants, and so I'm like, oh, that's Ben. Don't worry about it.
Not even.
That's just Ben.
Not even boxes. They'll be like confronting budgie smugglers. A confronting thong just floating through your living room.
Well, said socks are stuffed into the underwear, Ben, you know, that's not going to. Anyway, my friend and I used to make our way up to an observatory bar. It was this beautiful example of a classic Art Deco design, this place. We would settle down for a bite to eat and a chat when a man in front of us in the far corner caught my eye. It wasn't his dashing good looks that actually commanded my attention, but the look of sheer surprise on his face that I had noticed him. I couldn't help but stare, and he stared right back. But there was this communication between the two of them. It's like, oh, she's looking at me, and oh, he's looking at me. Apparently, though, he was dressed in this old kind of maintenance man's uniform, but he was very much flesh and blood. And she said, I nearly choked on my drink when he stepped up and walked straight through the wall next to the observation deck. She's like, he was solid. He was physical. I told my friend, but she couldn't see anything. Apparently the wall, like what was really strange as she's looking, he stepped back out halfway through the wall as if to say, yeah, I know that you can see me.
There was a bunch of those cases from the British Museum book I was covering a few weeks
was
back.
Was there?
Yeah. And because the place has been renovated so many times, they would often find that where the figure had walked and disappeared, that was the old library part.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that was the old place where there used to be a door or something.
See,
it's pretty common.
It is common, but I would subscribe to the stone tape theory with that kind of stuff. But with these reports, many of them do have an interaction. So I'm like, that can't be that it's just stored in the material. There's something else which is occurring.
Well, one of the guys that they, security guard saw was the old director of the museum from like early 1900s or late 1800s. And the idea was he was always walking around like he was lost. You know, people would see him like he was looking around lost. And the idea was the museum has changed so much since he was the director. He probably was lost.
Yeah, right.
He probably had no idea where he was.
See, I've heard stories that are similar to that, not from museums, but from certain like attractions, libraries. I think this particular one was from where there was someone who was, you know, looking for a particular book, and this kindly old gentleman comes along and he's like, oh, what are you looking for? And they strike up a conversation about this random topic. And he's like, oh, can I recommend this particular book? And you know, he goes over and he pulls the book out and he's like, oh, this has exactly what you're looking for. And the person was like quite shocked and so grateful for this guy. And because the book had everything they needed, I think they were rushing for an assignment or something. And when, if I recall correctly, I don't know if they had, they got a good mark or something. And so they wanted to go back to the library to thank him, right? And of course, when they go back to thank him, they find there's no such man. And of course, she describes what he looks like. And they're like, you mean that guy? And there's like a painting of like a former, you know, I don't know what they are, like a librarian that would have been there. And like, oh yeah, he's been dead for 50 years.
Yeah.
But isn't that cool? It's like we talk about these obsessions. Like,
it's not cool hanging out at a library.
Well, maybe it is.
Decades after you've died is sad and lame.
I don't think that's so at all. Like, imagine, but we talk about people getting caught up in their obsessions for smoking or drugs or something. But then you've got the opposite side of like they're just so in love with the library that
your consciousness is unlocked. You're free of the shackles of the flesh, and what you do is just hang out at your old job. It's the lamest thing you could ever imagine.
You're only saying that because you're fed up with being a podcaster.
Yeah. Imagine you died and you just, like I said, you can ascend to the dimensions, the upper dimensions, and you're just like, oh, I'll just do some more MU research.
You know what, though?
For another 100 years.
I really like libraries. There's something about the smell about them, the silence, especially old ones that are made of stone, like sandstone. Some of the ones in Sydney, like the sandstone ones. There's just something very...
Homeless people.
Well, not the ones that I went to.
Old men looking at porn on the computers.
I'm not talking about public
libraries. Drug addicts.
There are some much, much nicer libraries that you go to. I'm not talking about like the local council libraries.
You're saying that's what it is now.
Maybe. Yeah, that's a good point. But there is something about them. So I get it why, you know, someone would want to hang around in these places for, you know, in the afterlife. But the fact that they manifest in a physical way and they're capable of manipulating objects around them is very unusual. Like it just is so... contrasting to what people think a ghost is. People generally, I'm just talking about the general public, not you listening for the most part, but it's like it's a transparent form that, you know, floats about and makes the woo sound. Whereas no, many people...
Actually, that's what I'll be doing as well. In the socks, underpants, scythe, and I'll be doing the woo sound. Flicking the lights on and off. I'll be like, woo, flicking the
lights. While you're at it, why don't you just get like a big sheet of metal and then rattle it so it sounds like thunder?
Dragging chains. You're making that sound. You'll just wake up to that sound.
No, I don't want to wake up. Is it real? That's what I'll wake up to in the middle of the night. You got Joanna. She was once a nurse at a key London hospital, and while on night shift, the staff apparently would say that they saw a shadowy male figure creeping down one of the aisles, but they were never able to identify him. So they actually thought it was a form. They didn't think it was a ghost. Like, they thought it was a person, I'm sorry. Now, eventually a nurse at the far end of the room saw him and was able to get to him in time, and she realized that he apparently had just vanished, but there was no place for him to go. Like, she'd cornered him, and he was gone. So Joanna said that a number of dying patients from that hospital claimed that they would see a figure that would come to comfort them. So much like what we were describing before with, you know, the living being able to comfort people as they're passing on, apparently there are like these ghosts that sit around and help people move on to the afterlife as well, but from the other side.
Well, they're doing a pretty shitty job because it's all these lame ghosts hanging out at libraries and they're all places of employment.
That's true. Here's the other one, right? So this is a similar report from what I picked up. He says there were actually staff didn't believe the patients were talking to invisible entities until sometimes when they would look down, they would see a ghostly pair of shoes that were standing next to the bed with nothing seen above the ankles. I'm like, okay, that's
haunted Nikes.
Well, they're nurses, so they're probably sketches.
That's up there
or something,
with,
you know,
the haunted chimney story.
I like these stories. I don't care.
Be honest with us. How many haunted chimneys out of five do you give Andy Thomas's book?
Look, this book, because it can be a bit, it's really well written, but he's got a collection, and I think he kind of missed something here, in not a bad way though, but the book is quite long, and he describes these experiences of people, right? He goes, you know, they had this experience. But as you move through the book, you find out that this person also has this experience and this experience and this experience. It's like, oh, you're kind of like jumping around a lot. So it's like, I would rather it be all collected together, but that's just for my research purposes. I give this 5 smoking chimneys out of 5.
Five
smoking chimneys.
Haunted chimneys.
I give it 5 haunted chimneys. That's how good this book is.
That's
done a really, really great job.
Award-winning.
I think it's award-winning. Look, I strongly recommend that you pick this book up. I'll link to it in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org. Just a couple more things that I wanted to mention, because of course the hands, right? The hands is something that I want to mention. And it really struck a chord with me. What are we at? We got a little bit of time. So, My brother, this is a key memory that I have in my mind, and I can't get it out because it was so surreal. But when we were kids, my brother woke up screaming. We were in separate bedrooms, And he was completely flipping out. And he's never had night terrors or anything like that. Like, I don't think he had any kind of weird experiences like I had in this particular house. But he claims that he could, he awoke because a thumb had touched him on the head. Like, a hand had reached up from the back of his pillow and had touched him on the head. And, like, this completely freaked
him out. Did he see it or just feel it?
He just felt it, right?
How did he know it was a thumb?
Because he said it was like the thumb pushed him. Like, it was, but maybe he did, I can't remember exactly, but he was insistent it was this thumb that helped, it was part of a hand that had reached out from behind. And I've never really heard other reports. I mean, I've heard things like the hairy hands. That's the, you know, the Dartmoor thing, but that's very different to this kind of stuff. But where's this one here? So this comes from, this report here is from, is it Lucell? Just bring it up here. This is more of a malevolent kind of being, right? So Andy says that malevolent beings are sometimes said to group together. They do this in the lower astral realms, and they seem to have a cocktail of energies about them that, you know, allow them to manifest in obviously very dark ways, but they have certain assembly points. And strangely enough, some of these assembly points seem to be places like hotels. And I don't know why that is, but maybe it's like the transient nature of them. Again, like it becomes a liminal zone, allowing things to pass through perhaps a little bit easier. But he says this particular story of this witness, they were staying in this very strange casino right off the border of California and Nevada. Apparently it was like this particular building kind of just was in contrast to the nothingness that was out there. But she said, one night as I slept in our gold-plated, gold-leafed, chandeliered bedroom, like way over the top, I was facing downwards with my face pushed against the pillow when I felt a hand slip into my pillowcase. It was real and I thought I was awaking from a dream and I assumed that it was my partner's hand. So I gave it a stroke, but when I touched it, I sensed that something wasn't quite right. It felt too small to be his. Several moments later, I felt another hand slip onto mine from the other side. I immediately reacted by clawing at the hands, which I now know did not belong to my partner. Almost immediately in response to my change of sentiment, I suddenly felt a huge weight on my back from above. I could feel dozens and dozens of hands pushing down my spine all at once with so much force that I couldn't move at all. So she wasn't paralyzed. She was being held down by all of these spectral hands. She said it was absolutely terrifying and I fought with all of my energy to push this immense force off me, but I couldn't seem to shift. Then she kind of says that I called out for, she's like, it wasn't God. I just simply referred to the light. I don't know what I was doing, but I called out for the light and this seemingly instantaneously blasted all of these things away. It got rid of them and she was able to wake up. All these ghostly presences were gone. He writes, I sat bolt upright, quite shaken and also rather cross. Safe to say, I was happy to leave the very next day.
I've already debunked this case.
Oh, yes? And have you debunked it?
30-pack tiny finger hands from Amazon, $8.95.
Totally debunked.
I'm going to cut off your internet access while I'm telling stories so that you can't find these things. What, you think that a bunch of ghosts got a 30-pack of plastic hands?
It reminded me of that social media video of the Chinese guy. Asian guy going around traveling with his wife. What, and she'd always be trying to take photos of some tourist spot and he'd have one of these tiny plastic hands on a stick and she'd be enjoying this moment and he'd just put the stupid hand on her face.
Now, where this book, so this book isn't, and I realize I'm running out of time here. So
you
this,
are running out of time.
This book isn't just about ghostly apparitions and crisis apparitions and, you know, time slips and this kind of stuff. The book certainly goes into a whole wealth of other experiences, crossing into UFOs, you know, really weird alien reports. There is one that I will mention just before we
this
go.
This was my criticism of this, though.
What's that?
He writes about too much stuff.
Yeah, but it's...
When authors do that, you don't get anything in depth. Get a bunch of little stories.
Yeah, look, it's definitely a scattergun approach, but I see what he's doing, right? And this is why I really think that this is 5 smoking chimneys out of 5 because... Okay. He's trying to point out the fact, and there is this push. I mean, it's always been there, but there is this push at the moment amongst people to be like, let's just crush anything possible that's paranormal. Like, let's just destroy it. Let's shit on it. Let's, you know, just say how people are stupid if they believe in it. But the thing is, though, that is disconnecting us from these experiences because people, and it's actually quite detrimental. It's like talk about words being violence. Well, you know what? People that have these experiences, it psychologically messes them up. If they've been lulled into this belief that, oh no, all of this is a hallucination,
yeah,
all of this
dissonance.
Isn't real, it causes psychological disruption to people because they're too scared to talk about it. They're too scared to go. And sometimes these experiences, sometimes they can be rather banal, but other times they can be very dangerous. And for some people, it can completely overtake their lives. So to be like, oh no, science says that doesn't exist, is so ridiculously foolish, like extremely foolish.
Science fears the haunted chimney.
It does. And because it can't explain the haunted chimney.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this one report, actually, before I just finish off with this alien report talking about hands. It just so happens this week that Brent Swanser had a great write-up of strange portals spontaneously appearing in the home. And that's something that I might go into on Tuesday, actually, because he does, in the book, this is Andy, reference these weird orbs following people and, you know, strange rifts, you know, people getting, like, spirits getting caught in rifts and that kind of stuff. But Brent was writing up about these strange portals, and in the opening case, he mentions this case from a Reddit user who said, look, this happened to me when I was living in a small apartment. It was several years ago, and I didn't tell people about this story. But one evening, I woke up to feel someone touching my head, even though no one else was there.
I'll be doing that as well, by
right.
the way.
Apparently, though, listen to this, though. He sat up, right? And when he sat up, he said he looked around and he saw a square or rectangular hole cut in the air. Out of this hole shone a light, and there was a man's arm and hand protruding from it and waving around in the air. Now, he said this hole started drifting to the right and revolving around him, and he saw two young men in some other room. One was sitting there working or typing on something, and the other guy was looking about. I'm laughing because the guy is panicking, trying to work out, like, he was looking around the bedroom, but he says, they realized that I could see them. And the guy was panicking, trying to close the portal. That's why he had his hand down, trying to pull this portal closed to stop him from going on. He said they were definitely panicking to close this window or whatever it was. I've tried to tell
people
what
happened.
They're
in some government laboratory somewhere.
Yeah, and they just laugh at me. So this whole, like, weird phantom hand in the middle of the night is not so obscure as I thought that it was. And there was one other case that I'll just briefly mention, and this is actually a good example of where, you know, like, while I'm saying it's important that we talk about these topics and these stories and we indulge in them, for some people you can go too far. For some people you can really go over the deep end, go overboard, and it starts to, you know, affect you in other ways. Well, this particular guy just suddenly, I think it was after a lot of the Tic Tac UFO stuff came out, he got really obsessed about UFOs, mm-hmm. like really obsessed about UFOs, and was reading every book that he could find. And he would sit up late at night and reading all these books and possibly listening to Mysterious Universe. I don't know, but I'm going to assume he was. And he apparently one evening fell asleep. Again, there's this sleep element that comes in, but he fell asleep on his lounge and books everywhere and paperwork and whatever. And he awoke. He suddenly awoke because in the dark, like, something got his attention, and he looked up, and apparently there was, like, a gray alien arm that was, like, coming through something, like a rift in the room. And it had some type of instrument, and it was kind of adjusting the instrument, like preparing to use
one
it
of those pyramid fleshlights.
Maybe. I mean, maybe that's what it was. It doesn't say that, but maybe you're right. Maybe it was one of those pyramid fleshlights. It was like, as he's getting ready to use it.
You didn't need to do the sound.
Yes, I did.
The image was enough.
No, he said it was some weird trinket that this gray was using. And it's like, once he woke up, the gray was just kind of just discreetly pulls it back. Rift closes.
Oh, right, yeah.
Like, again, these weird arms and these manifestations, these physical manifestations. So look, there's so much more in this book. It's a really fantastic book. I strongly recommend it. Once again, 5 smoking chimneys out of 5. I'll link to it in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org, including Brent's article as well. And also some of these other reports of people having these strange encounters with these weird hands and you know, spiritual manifestations. All of it will be there at mysteriousuniverse.org.
Make sure you head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus to sign up for our plus extension. There's obviously more coming up on this episode. Big extension coming up. I'm going to be talking about this man, the lightning rod, Cleveland Sullivan, just to get us started into this strange topic of people that seem to be, yeah, lightning rods for literally lightning and strange esoteric activity as well. I've got a case where a man gets struck by lightning, and it leads to a woman in black encounter.
Oh, cool.
Very mysterious woman in black encounter. So that's coming up. Sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. You get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday. And of course, if you're a Plus member, you get an exclusive show every single Tuesday as well. If you sign up for the MU Max tier, you get access to our massive back catalogue going back 15, 16 years or so. Check it out. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU.
Good stuff coming up after the break if you're on Plus. For everyone else, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension.